You're listening to Crunch, a podcast by award-winning public relations agency, HMC. Crunch stands for Crucial Chats Over Lunch. These are bite-sized discussions for business leaders that can easily be digested over your lunch hour, on your morning commute, or whenever you listen to your favourite podcasts. Crunch tackles a variety of topics to help business leaders build their knowledge in strategic communication and public relations. On behalf of the HMC team, it's our privilege to welcome you into Crunch.
The media landscape in New Zealand has undergone significant changes over the past few decades, primarily due to the rise of digital technology. More recently, redundancies and closures are rife in the media industry, with the recent announcement that News Hub is being axed by its owners, Warner Brothers Discovery, and TVNZ also cutting jobs. This is just the latest in some major changes and most notably shrinkages happening across the New Zealand media landscape. Traditional media outlets like newspapers, magazines, and television have seen a decline in their dominance, making way, rightly or wrongly, for digital platforms such as social media blogs, online news portals, and others to fill the gap. Advancements in technology, shifts in consumer behavior, and the evolution of media platforms are just some of the things that we're going to talk about today as we discuss how these changes are reshaping the way businesses communicate and engage with media. I'm Heather Claycomb, Managing Director of HMC, and I'm joined today by one of our senior account managers, Kate Weber. Welcome, Kate.
Good morning.
And we are incredibly excited to have with us the founding editor of Business Desk, Patrick Smellie. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
For those of you who don't know Patrick, here's just a little introduction to him. Patrick has worked as both a journalist and communications manager in Wellington. In fact, many moons ago, Patrick, Heather and I both crossed paths with you when we were working for the same PR agency. Patrick's career highlights include being the Australian newspaper's first New Zealand correspondent in the mid-1990s, working as a junior press secretary to the then finance minister, Roger Douglas, for those of us who are old enough to remember Rogernomics. So that was back in the 80s, and 7 years in corporate communications at Contact Energy. In 2008, he founded Business Desk and remained the managing editor after its sale to NZME in January 22. And he's recently passed over the reins to his colleague, the talented Victoria Young, but still remains heavily involved in the publication's editorial decisions. And we're lucky enough to have had support from Patrick and his team for a number of our clients in recent times. So, Patrick, great to have you with us again.
Thanks very much. I feel like I've just been carbonated.
Excellent. So, Patrick, to kick us off, let's firstly talk about the most recent announcements and changes happening with News Hub closure and the announcement of more TVNZ cuts coming. There's been a lot of chatter out there. We've seen people talking about the demise of the Fourth Estate in New Zealand and the effect this will have on Kiwis and being able to, I guess, rely on the media sector to keep business, government accountable. Yeah, just start us out by giving us your thoughts on what's happening out there.
I guess the thing that really strikes me is that much of what's happening now is, I think, what we thought was going to happen in the early parts of COVID. If you recall then, the Bauer magazines, or Bauer, the publisher, pulled out of magazines in New Zealand, and that was seen as a possible cascade event. Nine, which owned Stuff, got very close to closing down Stuff in New Zealand before it was sold to Sinead Boucher for a dollar. I feel, though, as if what's happened is that because there was so much government largesse during the COVID period, both in wage subsidies and the Public Interest Journalism Fund, that everything sort of delayed the day. Now that we're in recessionary times, some of the structural weaknesses in the industry have become unsustainable, finally. I mean, in the case of News Hub, as a personal view, I think that whoever continued to fund News Hub's news gathering activities over about 20 or 30 years, never making any money apart from maybe once, they should get a medal. I mean, it's a difficult, expensive thing to do to make television news. It's always been tended to be regarded as being the lead-in product for evening viewing. And in an age where none of that stuff's getting cheaper to do, and where evening viewing or appointment viewing on linear TV is no longer necessarily what the majority of people are doing or will be doing in the next few years, the logic of making that investment in the news to bring the audience to the evening doesn't hold anymore, which is why you're starting to see a lot of discussion of 30-minute 6 o'clock news bulletins, one presenter. You know, I suspect probably quite a bit more sport and weather. I mean, if you think about a 30-minute broadcast, there's really only going to be 15 minutes for hard news in that.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's happening on the broadcast media front. In print and online, it's a slightly different story. There's a drift towards paid subscription models. Certainly in the case of Business Desk, we established ourselves in 2008 when the global financial crisis almost took us out within months of establishment. I guess one of the things we discovered at that point was that business news in particular seems to be somewhat recession-proof because people become concerned about their own financial circumstances and business conditions. And so we actually had a surge of subscriptions then. We also did have a surge of subscriptions in the most recent recessionary period as people seek trustworthy information or information that they hope is trustworthy to help them navigate the circumstances they find themselves in. Tougher, I think, if you're in, say, lifestyle or general news publishing, because it doesn't have quite the same urgent demand, if you like.
And I'm even guilty of writing something on LinkedIn about the demise of the Fourth Estate, you know, on the day that the News Hub information came out. But as a senior person in the industry, are you worried about this? Does this concern you? Or do you think, you know, this is just changes and they're going to, you know, it's all going to sort out in the end?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you pointed out, I did drink the Kool-Aid with Roger Douglas back in the 80s. So I do tend to have a certain amount of optimism that markets will sort things out. In the end, unless it's state-funded, news media does need to be a profitable enterprise. What we're seeing in New Zealand is no different from what we're seeing internationally. There's a bunch of different things happening at once. If you're happy for me to do so, I'd just give a quick encapsulation of, I think, what happened. First thing that happened was that the advertising dollars which used to go to newspapers started evaporating in the 2000s, the first decade of the century. By 2008, when the global financial crisis hit, advertising evaporated even more. And at the same time, newspapers were putting their product online for free. So basically losing the advertising revenue stream and losing the subscription revenue stream at once. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to work out what's going to happen. Basically, you're not going to have any revenue. And the industry as a whole has been rowing back from that, but really only started to do so in a sort of a dedicated fashion, if you like, in the last 3 or 4 years, I think. I think one of the reasons that Business Desk has been reasonably successful is that we've never been free. And when we went from a wholesale content provider, which we used to sell all of our news to other publishers, to putting our own news behind our own paywall and running our own brand, the one thing that's consistent there is that we never worked for free. And I think the other thing that helped us was that we were always very lean by comparison with the traditional publishers. So there's a whole kind of intergenerational clean-out going on in a way as to the way that traditional media has been created. If I think back to when I started at the Dominion in the 1980s, if you wrote a story, it was on little pieces of paper, which were then taken upstairs to two sets of sub-editors who then took it to the reading room. The readers read it. Then it went and was composed in physical type by a gang of men down in the basement who then published the newspaper. None of that happens now. And for Business Desk, all we ever really needed was good people and an internet connection. So the difference in cost base is huge. And I think that that is still the case. The thing that worries me most, though, is that in an age of social media and in an age in which basically anybody can set themselves up with a Substack and call themselves a journalist, the fracturing of available sources of information becomes a social and political issue because it's so hard to get a cohesive view about anything. Whereas in the past, we all just used to read the Herald or the Dominion, and we all listened to Radio New Zealand News, and we all saw the TVNZ News at 6 o'clock, and we all consumed much the same news. Now we've got everybody's consuming their own private feed to some degree. And you know, that's a real challenge for traditional journalism.
So, Patrick, perhaps you have some insight for businesses looking to continue to engage with media. I mean, you know, we know the importance of helping our clients have great journalist relationships, but it's becoming increasingly challenging. There are less of them to have relationships with, I suppose. Fewer outlets. Some have amalgamated into one news desk that controls many different outlets. You know, for instance, Stuff and community newspapers. I know our rural clients really miss a lot of the community papers that are no longer really there anymore. And running stories that garner clicks is often, you know, top of mind. So how do business leaders make sure that their message stands out? You know, is the good news story different than it was a few years ago? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think some of the basics still apply. Stories that involve people, stories that have good illustrations, professionally shot, not just something you did on your iPhone in low light early this morning. Yes. For business journalism, I'm very strict about it. If the story doesn't have numbers, we probably won't run it. We need numbers.
That's an interesting insight.
All businesses that aren't listed on the stock exchange are nervous about giving any kind of numbers, right? They don't have to. They don't normally do so. They don't have to publicly disclose. And that's one of the joys of being a privately owned company. But from our perspective, if somebody says they're doing really well, well, that doesn't really mean anything. We need to know at least some kind of size and scope as to what doing well means.
It's also about being transparent, Patrick, at the end of the day, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I mean, it's not a good example, but we do get a lot of press statements from enthusiastic amateurs who've invented something in their garage. And, you know, the first thing you say is, have you sold any? If they say no, we'll say, come back in about 2 years' time and you've actually sold some and maybe somebody's put some money into your business other than yourself and see what we think.
I think it's a lens that we put over the content we create as well. Like if I'm thinking about some of the stories I've written in recent weeks, if a client wants to make a claim, it's like, well, we're going to need to reference that and put some data behind it to actually demonstrate that it's true. And I think in the age of digital where the lines between what's fact and what's fiction are even more blurred, you know, putting those numbers and facts, like Patrick says, behind what you're saying or claiming is just even more important because there is an element of mistrust out there.
The thing is also that at a certain point, it's possible now for any business to tell its audience anything it likes through any number of channels, from as simple as email through to paid advertising through to social media. We know from, say, the Edelman Global Trust Barometer that trust in social media is far lower than trust in journalism, even though trust in journalism is not particularly flash. Old style journalism is still more trusted than a channel that the creator of the content has control over. And so partly for us, it's also, why are people going to be willing to pay to read this news if they can get it everywhere else anyway? So always, I guess, expect that you need to be willing to be a little more disclosive, to be a little more willing to discuss your strategy, your business model and so forth with a journalist if you really want decent coverage. If you want to just, you know, shoot it out on social media, have your story out there in the form that makes you feel comfortable, that's fine, but it's not likely to necessarily move the dial for a newsroom. And you know, I get literally a couple of hundred emails a day, unsolicited, with possible story ideas. And sifting amongst them means that I miss the occasional gem, but it's a pretty brutal process. You haven't got enough time in the day to spend time thinking carefully about every one of them. There needs to be a standout element.
And I think that was good, just what you said about like being willing to discuss with a journalist, sort of, you know, what does the journalist want? What do I want as a company? And how can we kind of do this together, sort of thing? And that really comes down to having really great relationships with some really key journalists, I suppose.
I think it's really important to be careful about not thinking of the journalist as your friend. That's the terrible thing about this industry, is that you can be as friendly and polite as you like as a journalist or as a source. But one day, if things turn to custard, I'm going to write a horrible story about you. It's just the way it is. So it's important to regard the relationship as professional. And I guess one of the things that I found over many years working as a journalist and working in your industry as well is that it makes an enormous difference if you've already met the reporter and have a rapport and a relationship already. Because I'm not speaking against any particular colleague of mine, but there are some journalists that a company would not want to deal with, and there are others that they would. And if they haven't met them and had an opportunity to get a sense of the person that they're going to be talking to and trusting their story to be told properly to, or in a way that's at least fair and accurate, then it's going to be more of a pig in a poke, really. You know, just poke a press statement out there and hope someone picks it up. It's different from already having met somebody, already having maybe chatted a bit of stuff through, not for the record, but just for the purposes of understanding, and then maybe down the track it becomes something that gets written about.
Yeah, good point. So do you think you've become pickier over the years in terms of like what you run as a news story than you were 10 years ago?
We do try to be pickier. we're a subscription-based news service now, and so we should be adding value wherever we can. So we're much less likely to turn stuff around quickly. Although, if it's a major news story and we know there's going to be heavily read, we do also want to be the place where people feel that they will get all the business news they need. And so basic news judgment still applies. We're probably much less interested these days in, it used to be sort of a bit of a fad for commissioned research. We would get things from a company would saying, we've asked 500 customers such and such. And you think, well, unless that's really got proper methodology behind it.
Yeah, and independence. And
it's basically just arm waving. So I'm certainly much less willing these days to take at face value what's often served up as if it were credible research. And generally speaking, there needs to be some kind of wow factor to make it worth doing. But there's nothing new in that.
No, and I was thinking about how the media is often criticized because they're so interested in clicks, but really that's not any different than it has been. You know, the news, people are going to look at it, whether it was in a newspaper or listening to it on the radio, if it has a good headline and a good intro, right?
So, it's a bit of a dark art, isn't it? I mean, I'd like to think of myself as a serious journalist, but I'm routinely guilty of writing inflammatory headlines in the interest of getting people to read things. It's a game that I think I trust readers to understand because, you know, you are trying to get read. Being a responsible journalist doesn't mean being boring.
Yes.
If that was one thing that I would say right now is that just a tip generally for business people is that, firstly, a journalist shouldn't agree to renegotiate the quotes after the fact. Whatever you said, please try to make it the thing you meant to say. You know, if you're very inexperienced in the media, we might be nice to you. But my constant experience where I have been foolish enough to agree to let people look at their quotes is that they almost immediately pick on the things where they've chosen to be interesting and made their comments more bland. Readers don't want bland comments. They want they want opinion. They want character and personality. It feels like a terrible risk. But, you know, as soon as you feel yourself putting your lawyer's hat on, because you've been a little bit entertaining in the way that you've expressed yourself, just take it back off again. It's very, very unlikely that you've done anything other than made your story more readable.
That's good. That's a really good point. New clients that come to us and we're just getting them started working with media, you know, often they don't understand that, you know, if they see something and it's not exactly correct, you know, they get, they want us to go back to the journalists and ask them to correct something that's already in print. And as we all know, that's just not the way it works.
I would say that we understand we make mistakes.
Yeah.
And certainly our policy is to correct quickly and apologetically major mistakes. A lot of times people think that a matter of judgment or nuance is a mistake, and it's often not a mistake. It's just that we don't quite see it the same way as they do.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think too it highlights the importance of businesses being prepared. You know, if you are going to proactively put out a story, be prepared with those key messages that, you know, if you're going to have an interview with a journalist, you know that there are three or four key messages you want them to take away.
And it's my job to try to get you to come up with a fifth that you hadn't intended to say. There's always more underneath what you've chosen to say, and it's a journalist's job to try to unearth that. It's not about gotcha. It's about wanting to go deeper. It's want to understand better. And that's why I say, I don't think all of my colleagues would agree with me about this, but that's why I would say have a conversation that's a conversation before you do the interview.
I like that.
Get clear with the journalist the broad area that you're going to cover. It can be a lot easier. And if you create a slightly more trusting environment, I mean, it's, you know, it's nerve-wracking for people who don't normally do media to go in the media because, as you say, Kate, we don't always get absolutely everything right the way that they would like it to be. And that's just the way it's going to be.
I think, you know, I always talk to our clients about the difference between sales messages and PR messages.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're not here to sell a product. Mm-hmm. We're here to tell your story, demonstrate your expertise, and add value to the people that are reading it. And I think it's also important to tailor your story to the publication and its readers. For example, I might sell a story into the Waikato Times, and that has to have a local angle and be relevant to the Waikato. And it will not be the same story that I send to the Southland Times, obviously. So really understanding and really making an effort, and for the journalist to see that you've made an effort rather than just emailing them the stock standard media release. Obviously making sure it's topical and relevant. Maybe there's an issue going on at the time that you can weave into your story that's relevant. I think, Patrick, and this is based on my experience with some of my clients, the media are still perceived as the bad guys. And, you know, there's a huge nervousness and trepidation from a lot of senior leaders about talking to journos and, oh, are they going to throw me under the bus? And do you think that's still the case?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just speaking really frankly, I think journalists come in all shapes and sizes. Some see their job as to trip you up. Others see that as their job to understand what's going on and write about it. You maybe want to try and veer more towards the latter than the former. There's also questions of experience. So one of the issues that I know frustrates, and I've talked about this many, many times with PR people and their clients, is that they say, well, we spend all this time training up one reporter that understands our issue, and then lo and behold, they're the police reporter, or they've gone off to work somewhere else, or, was that a waste of time? And maybe it's a little bit Pollyanna-ish, but I don't think it's ever a waste of time, because those journalists still hold that knowledge, right? And they still work somewhere. It's frustrating and it's inevitable. I mean, now I've been at business desk for 16 years, but that's only because I've started the business. There are very few people who spend that long in any job. So, you know, there's a bit of picking and choosing probably required, and a bit of, as I say, just realism about how much time journalists have to put into things as well. You know, newsrooms are small. And the ability to go deep is difficult, and the decision to go deep is generally pretty carefully thought about. So a lot of the time you may feel that's right, kind of surfacey coverage, but a lot of the time we are skating over a very wide range of different things. I mean, that's the great joy of journalism, is that you're always looking at something different. The pitfall is that you're never going to be an expert in the way that the people that you talk to are.
I think that's something for business leaders to remember. At the end of the day, they are the experts on this topic. If you approach it in a, you know, with that confidence that you're the one that holds the knowledge on this topic.
But also be realistic about what it is that you want people to take away. So an anecdotal example I would give is that when I worked at Contact Energy, I would have probably once a week a discussion with somebody who would say, if we could just explain to people how the electricity system works, they'd be much happier about how much they're paying for it. And I would say, no, they wouldn't. Complete nonsense. They just want to turn the lights on.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think business leaders have this view that people just don't understand them well enough, and if they just would, that everything would be fine. That's very unlikely to be the case. At Contact, I mean, this is now 15 years old, so it's not really the strategy anymore, but we basically came up with the decision that we should stop trying to be understood and just try to be liked. Much simpler. We keep on doing the government relations. You talk to the specialist electricity reporters and energy reporters, the people who needed to understand how it all worked, understood. But that was never going to be your kind of macro strategy for marketing success or whatever. And talking on that, you know, Business Desk and the Herald, for example, quite different. If you're pitching to the general section of the New Zealand Herald, that would be a different thing from pitching to the business section of the New Zealand Herald, and it would be a different thing again to be pitching to Business Desk. So for Business Desk, we have a much smaller, higher net worth decision-making, policy-making, C-suite and reports, plus serious investors. So they're relatively sophisticated readers. They don't need to be told stuff that most people may not know, but they do want something deeper and more difficult to understand. A mundane example, if Air New Zealand announced that they were going to create a new kind of seat and also talked about the problems they were having with aircraft engine maintenance, the seat is the Herald story, the engine maintenance story is for us.
Yeah, interesting.
Particularly with the numbers.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think different media outlets in the last couple of years, I think, have really found their place. You know, even if they're mass media, they've sort of found their place. And I think that's a conversation we have with our clients when we get a story. It's like, where does that belong? And, you know, we understand, oh, yeah, that's a Business Desk article, or that's a Herald article, or stuff. And I think the great thing, too, you know, an advantage of the changes in the media landscape is there are so many other, there's a lot of niche players as well.
That's the end of part one of this two-part episode of Crunch. There's much more to come with this incredible guest, so hit the subscribe button because you don't want to miss out on our continued conversation and advice for business leaders. Thank you for joining us for the Crunch podcast today, brought to you by New Zealand PR agency HMC. See you next time.